Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1150, The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy, Part 5. This is being recorded on September 6th of the year 2020. Well, it is Labor Day weekend, and what comes to mind is a grim pun on labor, and that would be looking at labor as the contractions at birth, and that in turn, in the context of the old poem, what rough beast slouches toward Bethlehem, waiting to be born. And we are going to be taking a look at that. We have been taking a look at the past and how the legacy of what really is the merging of the U.S. During and immediately after World War II with the Axis, a reconstituted Axis epitomized by the Trilateral Commission. The three sides of that commission are Japan, Germany, and the U.S. In the interests of time, I'm not going to sum up what we have been looking at in the other programs because I have a lot of material on hand to bring up to date. We are going, although we have been dealing with events during and immediately after World War II and proceeding up through time, we've gotten up through the Watergate scandal, we are going to be looking at things that track right up to the present. However, the world today cannot be properly understood without understanding what it was that took place during and after World War II and in the context of what we are talking about. I'm going to plunge right back in and take a look at an excerpt from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. It is the story of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground, the element that I believe is going to prove to be the decisive factor in human affairs on this planet. I am afraid and firmly believe that the future will be theirs. Talking about Richard Nixon and the Nixon White House, and we will be talking about William Casey later, Nixon's close friend and associate B.B. Rebozo had a bank that was, among other things, the recipient of a great deal of money coming from the Bormann Network. The German South American group also had direct access to the Nixon White House through the representatives in Washington and were proud of the fact that B.B. Rebozo was President Nixon's closest friend. For knowingly or unknowingly, Rebozo processed millions of their dollars through his Florida bank as part of normal commercial operations. Now, keeping that in mind, we are going to take a look and review and supplement an unpublished essay that we looked at in our last program. It is titled Mengele and Dulles, The SS-OSS Connection, Transnationalism and the Cold War. This was authored by a researcher that is well known to veteran listeners. However, because of the fact that the manuscript was never published, I'm going to leave that, leave his name out of this. Looking at the conclusion of this, I'm repeating this from our last program, and in the context of B.B. Rebozo and the remarkable Bormann connections discussed in that excerpt. One of the most researched and ill-understood stories about such payments concerns a Bahamas casino, Paradise Island, which figured in investigative stories about Richard Nixon and Watergate. The casino was owned by an American company, the Mary Carter Paint Company, later known as Resorts International, and there is no question but that, in 1968, the chairman of the company, James Crosby, quote, made a $1,000 contribution to the Nixon campaign. It took the unusual form of 34 different checks, 33 of them for $3,000 apiece, the last for $1,000. In 1972, Howard Hunt, in his double capacity as an employee of the Nixon White House and of a CIA-linked publicity relations firm, the Robert Mullen Agency, that's M-U-L-L-E-N, did certain work for Intertel, an investigative and intelligence subsidiary of Resorts International, of Resorts. Intertel was trying to hush up allegations based on a controversial internal memorandum from a woman named Deetha Beard about a $400,000 payoff to the Republican Party in exchange for a settlement of a Justice Department suit against IT&T, by the way. In the first program in this series, For the Record Program 1146, we concluded with some of the discussions that were taking place in early 1943 between Alan Dulles and Prince Max Eggen von Hohenlohe of the Habsburgs. Hohenlohe, in turn, was a representative of Walter Schellenberg, who was in charge of overseas intelligence for the Seekerites, means the SD. That was the SS Intelligence Service. Schellenberg was also a director of IT&T. Continuing. In 1972, Resorts James Crosby made no acknowledged contribution to Nixon, even though he was reportedly asked by Nixon's personal lawyer, Herbert Kalmbach. But in 1973, the New York Times ran a story about, quote, peculiar movements between the Paradise Island Casino and the Key Biscayne Bank, which belonged to then-President Richard Nixon's friend, B.B. Rebozo. There was speculation that the bank and the casino were laundering funds for the president. The story focused on the movements of a close friend of Rebozo called Seymour Alter, A-L-T-E-R, quote, whom a lot of people called Resorts Bagman, unquote. Testimony by an IRS informant to a House subcommittee 2 years later suggested that the money was in fact skimmed from another of James Crosby's companies, the Paradise Island Bridge Company, and that Alter had on at least one occasion carried $200,000 of such money and been met on a Key Biscayne dock by B.B. Rebozo himself. Quote, they headed for either B.B.'s or Nixon's house, unquote. Throughout the Watergate scandal, there were rumors among investigative reporters that Nixon and Rebozo were silent partners with Crosby in the lucrative bridge company. I myself was sent a list of the shareholders at this time. The list, later confirmed by Crosby in public testimony, did not show Nixon or Rebozo. It did, however, name a number of German and Swiss investors. One of these, for example, was Dr. Heinz, H-E-I-N-Z, Rosterg, R-O-S-T-E-R-G, of Lausanne, Switzerland, a former, quote, principal stockholder, unquote, and director of the Wintershall Potash Concern. Wintershall was one of the major subsidiaries of BASF, the largest single successor firm to IG Farben. By itself, this would be a tenuous link between the CIA, Galen, IG Farben connection, and the alleged payments to Richard Nixon. But the same IRS informant testified the links later corroborated by investigative journalists between Resorts and a Bahamas bank, Castle Bank, which the Wall Street Journal later revealed to have had among its deposits, quote, a $5 million CIA fund. Castle Bank had been founded by an OSS and CIA veteran, Paul Helliwell, whose role in helping to consolidate the post-war CIA mafia and narcotics connection I have described elsewhere. The CIA's operational interest in the mob-connected Castle Bank was so great that, according to Wall Street Journal, the Justice Department dropped its pursuit of Castle Bank under pressure from the CIA. The Wall Street Journal's revelation about interest in a controversial claim printed 4 years earlier in the Rolling Stone magazine that Resorts International, quote, in its earlier incarnation as Mary Carter Paint, was a CIA front set up by former New York District Attorney and Governor Thomas Dewey and Alan Dulles, first chief of the CIA, to launder funds to support counterinsurgency groups in Latin America. Parenthetically, Dulles was not the first head of the CIA, but one of the first, and someone who really was the midwife, so to speak, of CIA. Thomas Dewey, of course, was the 1948, also 44, but 1948 Republican presidential candidate. Alan Dulles was his chief campaign official with the official title of speechwriter, and it was the 1948 campaign, as we reviewed in our last program, that saw the genesis of the fusing of the Republican Party with the Galen Organization and what John Loftus called the Fascist Freedom Fighters. We will review that. We'll speak about that as we talk about William Casey later on in the program. Continuing. After a suit for libel by Resorts, Rolling Stone retracted the claim. Still unanswered is the question of whether the story of the Dewey, Alan Dulles interest in Resorts International should have referred to funds not from the CIA itself, but from its German, Swiss partners in the Paradise Island Bridge Company. Such a hypothesis might explain some of the many strange coincidences which surround the company's controversial history. It might, for example, explain the, quote, fortune in legal fees, unquote, that Mary Carter Paint, on the advice of Thomas Dewey, paid to Alan Dulles' longtime law partner David Peck. The SS-OSS connection certainly had reason to be grateful to David Peck. It was on the basis of Peck's recommendation as chairman of a three-man advisory board to review all the Nuremberg sentences that John J. McCloy commuted the time served. It was on the basis of Peck's recommendation as chairman of a three-man advisory board to review all the Nuremberg sentences that John J. McCloy commuted the time served the sentence of Skorzeny's post-war employer Baron Alfred Krupp and eight of his colleagues, and also ordered Krupp's property to be restored. The release of Krupp and other industrialists fulfilled an earlier demand to McCloy from Hermann Abs, who himself narrowly escaped prosecution at Nuremberg. Abs was the first post-war chairman of BASF, the IG Farben successor company represented among the stockholders of the Paradise Island Bridge Company. Might not the OSS-SS connection also throw light on the unexplained interlock between James Crosby's company Resorts, beginning again? Might not the OSS-SS connection also throw light on the unexplained interlock between James Crosby's company Resorts International, tightly controlled by the related and doubly intermarried Crosby and Murphy families and Capital Cities Broadcasting, the major investment of the CIA's present director, William Casey. Casey would be the logical person to have established the original connection between the Crosby-Murphy families and their mysterious German-Swiss partners. For it was William Casey in 1944 to 1945 who, quote, was given overall operational control of OSS German projects and, quote, coordinated the over 150 men whom OSS sent into Germany. With Dulles, Wisner, and Forgan, Casey was also one of the OSS veterans who lobbied successfully for a CIA which could legitimately utilize the resources of the Galen organization. And of the intermarrying between James Crosby and Thomas S. Murphy, in the footnote that author notes, James Crosby's cousin and brother-in-law Thomas S. Murphy was in 1964 the executive vice president and the director of Capital Cities, as well as a director of Mary Carter Paint. Lowell Thomas, a longtime radio broadcaster with intelligence connections, was a director of both companies. At the time, William Casey was an officer, director, and major stockholder of Capital Cities. For more on the takeover of ABC by Capital Cities, after CIA had lodged an unprecedented complaint about ABC News with the Federal Communications Commission, note cover-ups from May of 1985. By the way, another of the founders of Capital Cities Incorporated, which bought out ABC. It became the parent company. Eventually, ABC merged with the Disney Corporation to become ABC Disney. Another of the original founders of Cap Cities, along with William Casey and Thomas Murphy, was the aforementioned Thomas Dewey. And we're just to bring this up to the present. People, particularly younger listeners, are saying, well, it was a long time ago, and, you know, Dave's always talking about World War II, and, you know, so what? That was a long time ago. We're going to talk about Resorts International. Now, bearing in mind the Paradise Island Bridge Company overlapping Resorts International, and how the aforementioned Resorts International and its overlapping Paradise Island Bridge Company may very well be involved with the merger of the coalescence of Cap Cities, which is heavily overlapped in terms of personnel and management with Cap Cities. We're going to take a look at who became the successor owner and chairman of Resorts International after what was called the unexpected death of James Crosby in 1986. I would note that it was in 1986 that the Iran-Contra scandal broke, and William Casey died of cancer late in that year. From the Wikipedia entry on Resorts International. Crosby died unexpectedly in April of 1986, and Resorts International became a takeover target. The Taj Mahal Casino in Atlantic City, New Jersey, had encountered construction problems, and Crosby's heirs, lacking experience in large development projects, doubted their ability to complete it successfully. Real estate developer Donald Trump, who owned two Atlantic City casinos, beat out several other bidders to purchase a controlling stake in the company from Crosby's family for $79 million in July of 1987. Trump was appointed chairman of Resorts International and said he would complete the Taj Mahal in about a year. As the Taj Mahal's budget had ballooned to $930 million, Resorts struggled to find the financing to complete it. With the company claiming to be near bankruptcy in early 1988, Trump made a tender offer to buy all outstanding stock for $22 a share, stating that he was willing to personally finance the construction, but only if he owned the entire company. Television producer Merv Griffin made an unexpected offer to purchase the company for $35 a share, sparking a highly publicized takeover battle, with Trump and Griffin filing lawsuits against each other. The two ultimately reached a settlement, which was executed in November of 1988, with Griffin purchasing the company for $365 million and Trump purchasing the Taj Mahal from the company for $273 million. Again, note that after James Crosby, for a period of time, none other than Donald Trump became the owner and chairman of Resorts International. Ultimately, Merv Griffin and Donald Trump split the assets. Bear in mind also that Donald Trump's banking oasis, so to speak, for many years was none other than Deutsche Bank, whose chairman emeritus was Hermann Abs, the first chairman of BASF, and spoken about in that excerpt from that unpublished essay. Now, turning to an article originally published in the LA Weekly of February 20th through 27th of 1987 by the late Andy Boehm, B-O-E-H-M. This is available on the KennedysandKing.com website. That is the website of the estimable Jim Giugemio, whose remarkable work on the Garrison investigation I accessed in the For the Record programs numbers 1,031 through 1,056, with the exception of 1,039. This is called The Seizing of the American Broadcasting Company, and it talks a little bit about the circumstances surrounding Cap City's purchase of, or takeover of, ABC, and this again following a complaint by the CIA, headed up by William Casey, who was one of the principal people involved with the Nazi connection, the Nazi element of the Republican Party. Again, the GOP and the Galen Organization are heavily overlapped. The main figures involved in that Nazi, the Nazi branch of the Republican Party, going out of Thomas Dewey's 1948 campaign. It was the brainchild of Alan Dulles. The guy who headed it up was Dulles' protege, Richard Nixon. The chief spokesperson for that was Ronald Reagan, and the State Department machinations to bring the Eastern European Nazi collaborators over to the U.S. was William Casey, who was in charge, as we looked at, of all OSS operations in Europe, and in Germany, I should say, in late 1944 and 1945. And Andy Boehm writes as follows in The Seizing of the American Broadcasting Company. Cap Cities was founded in 1954 by several men who were or would become prominent. Chief among them and the principal players in the company were famed explorer newscaster Lowell Thomas, Tom Dewey, the former New York governor and twice GOP candidate for president, both like most other Cap City's founders, not now deceased, and William J. Casey, who was Cap City's chief counsel and a member of its board of directors until 1981 when he joined the Reagan administration. He, bear in mind this was written in 1987 while Casey died in 86, he still owns $7.5 million in stock in the now-merged entity called Capital Cities ABC, his largest holding. And I guess this was written just before Casey's death, although published in 87, early 87. On November 21st, 1984, the CIA asked the Federal Communications Commission to strip ABC of its 5 TV and 14 radio station licenses. ABC has hundreds of affiliate radio and TV stations, but it's legally limited to owning just a few stations, all of which are located in the biggest and most lucrative markets. Bear in mind, this is in 1987. The CIA was ostensibly upset because on September 19th to 20th, 1984, ABC News had aired allegations that the agency had contracted for the murder of Ron Reedwald, a Honolulu swindler who claimed that his scams were directed by the CIA, of which he claimed to be a secret agent. The story supposedly so enraged then CIA Director William Casey that he asked the FCC to strike the ultimate economic death blow to ABC by revoking its station licenses. In February of 1985, the CIA reduced its demands to asking for FCC penalties under the Fairness Doctrine, which requires that the broadcasters to air at least two sides of controversial issues of public importance. In both FCC complaints, Bill Casey's CIA became the first government agency ever to seek such redress from the news media. On March 18, 1985, while the FCC considered Casey's complaints, ABC agreed to be acquired by Cap Cities, a media conglomerate with the lowest profile and highest profit margins in the broadcasting business. It was a, quote, friendly, unquote, takeover. ABC Chief Leonard Goldenson and Capital Cities President Tom Murphy had been close friends for years. Cap Cities also owns daily papers in Fort Worth and Kansas City, trade journals including Women's Wear Daily, and at the time, 55 cable TV systems. What might explain the change of What might explain the chain of events that began with Casey attacking ABC and ending with Cap Cities buying the network? Of course, Casey may have simply been outraged at ABC for airing a false story about a CIA murder plot. Even some CIA critics had concluded the story was untrue. Unfortunately, we'll probably never know. The judge at the Rewald trial sealed all evidence relating to the CIA. By the way, the company, which many suspected was a successor to the Nugenheim Bank, was BBRBW. That was Bishop Baldwin, Rewald, Billingham, and Long. In that trial, by the way, one of the counsels was Daniel Sheehan, now of the Romero Institute. We are going to review a bit about William Casey, talking about Capital Cities Incorporated, and also we are going to talk about Casey's apparent role in the handling of the enormous amount of gold that was acquired first by Japan under the Golden Lily operation, and then later became fused with U.S. intelligence apparatus at one level, and even beyond that became a foundational element of the post-World War II global economy. That is documented very effectively in the book Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold by Sterling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave that we have used so often. This, by the way, was the excerpt I'm about to read was used in For the Record program 1145 from Gold Warriors about William Casey. Many CIA agents spent years or even decades under various covers, so it was hard to establish beyond any doubt whether they ever left the agency or merely went underground. A perfect example is William Casey. Casey was one of the original OSS crowd. After law school, he went to work for an accounting firm but kept in touch with fellow lawyer John Pop Howley, who worked for Wild Bill Donovan's law firm, Donovan Leisure Newton in Irvine. When Donovan became head of the OSS, Casey and Howley joined him. By the way, note Paul Hellowell here. He was involved with Castle Bank that was spoken of in that Mengele OSS and Mengele and Dulles, the SS OSS connection, the unpublished essay that we read earlier in the program. Continuing. When Donovan became head of the OSS, both Casey and Howley joined him. Casey was John Singlaub's case officer in the war, while Paul Hellowell was Singlaub's direct superior. Casey was also a close friend of Alan Dulles, and John Foster Dulles worked with Ray Klein and became involved with Lansdale as Santa Romana's torture of Major Kojima was bearing fruit. This put Casey in the position to know a great deal about the Black Eagle Trust, and one source insists that Casey's financial skills made him one of the key players, along with Paul Hellowell and Edwin Pauley, in implementing the Black Eagle Trust under the guidance of Robert B. Anderson and John J. McCloy. Following the war, Casey and his old friend Howell founded their own Wall Street law firm. But what made Casey really wealthy was his involvement with other former intelligence officers in setting up the media holding company Capital Cities in 1954. According to many investigators, during this period, the CIA poured millions into setting up front companies for covert operations in broadcasting and publishing, and it is alleged that Casey funneled some of these funds into Capital Cities to acquire failing media companies and turn them around. It is likely that Casey never left the agency, but only molted into one of its financial butterflies. It would not be the first time a senior CIA agent has had a double career on Wall Street, Alan Dulles being but one of many others. From 1971 to 1973, Casey was Nixon's appointee as chief of the Securities and Exchange Commission, where he worked closely with SEC attorney Stanley Sporkin, later appointed by Casey as CIA general counsel and involved in the Norbert Schley case. Casey also served as Nixon's Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs and Chairman of the Export-Import Bank. In 1978, Casey founded a think tank called the Manhattan Institute that absorbed a number of former CIA officers and funneled money from conservative foundations to conservative authors. When Casey left Capital Cities to head the Reagan presidential campaign and then to become Reagan's director of the CIA, he is said to have been its biggest single stockholder with $7.5 million in Capital Cities stock. He was still its biggest stockholder and CIA director in 1985 when Capital Cities bought ABC. A man who was involved in covert financial operations throughout his entire career, Casey had links to all the players in this book. His DNA is all over the place, from pre-Santa Romana to post-Marcos. He was one of the men who dreamed up the privatization of the CIA, and as CIA director, he showed Reagan how to implement it. One of Reagan's first acts was to sign Executive Order 12333, which authorized the CIA and other government agencies to enter into contracts with private military foundations, quote, and need not reveal the sponsorship of such contracts or arrangements for authorized intelligence purposes, unquote. This put Casey back in harness with Klein, Singlaub, Shackley, Lansdale, and many others purged earlier while obscuring their activities, keeping them theoretically at least in the private domain. Simultaneously, Casey personally took over handling President Marcos, pressing him to provide black gold for covert purposes, and finally masterminding the downfall and removal of Marcos and his bullion. Eventually, Iran-Contra revealed the intimate bonds between members of the enterprise and unelected officials of the National Security Council, Pentagon, and CIA. And again, it was William Casey who was the head of CIA when they filed the complaint against ABC, and he was still Cap City's largest stockholder when it took over ABC. And bear in mind the ruminations in that unpublished essay about links between the Paradise Island Bridge Company, which may very well have been a Borman property, and Cap Cities and Resorts International and William Casey. Bear in mind also that Thomas Dewey was one of the founders of Cap Cities, and it was Thomas Dewey's campaign in 1948 that saw the genesis of the Nazi branch of the Republican Party. We would note that it was the Mary Carter Paint Company that paid a huge amount, what was described as a fortune in legal fees, to David Peck, who was Alan Dulles' law partner. It was also David Peck, who reviewed the sentences of the men convicted at Nuremberg and made recommendations to John J. McCauley, who was U.S. High Commissioner of Germany, and later, along with Alan Dulles, became key members of the Warren Commission, headed up, by the way, by former Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Earl Warren, who had been Thomas Dewey's vice presidential candidate, I should say, in 1948, when Alan Dulles was managing the campaign. Once again, bringing all of this up to the present, or rather tying in this past and showing how it intersects with and evolved into the present political configuration, bear in mind what we looked at in For the Record programs 1147, 1148, and 1149 about the Dulles SS-OSS negotiations, and in particular how they were taking place in Italy. That was part of the Operation Sunrise negotiation between Alan Dulles and Reichswehr SS Heinrich Himmler's personal adjutant, General Karl Wolff. That took place in Italy, and ultimately one of the main people involved in helping to facilitate that liaison was Walter Rauff, an SS officer who had set up the mobile gas chambers on the Eastern Front in World War II. We're going to take a look at an article called The Advocate by Matthias Schwartz from the New York Times Magazine of June 7th of 2020 in the Western Edition. And William Barr, of course, is now in his second term as Attorney General. He served as Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, who made the Nazi branch of the Republican Party a permanent part of the Republican Party, as we have looked at in the past, and as we reviewed in our last program. Of William Barr was himself a longtime CIA officer, and in turn, his father, Donald Barr, served in the OSS under Alan Dulles, William Donovan, with William Casey et al. Interestingly enough, he may very well have served in Italy. He learned Italian as part of his military intelligence training and then was shipped to Europe. It is unclear what exactly he did in Europe. He then eventually became part of the Interim Research and Intelligence Service, which morphed into the State Department's in-house intelligence branch, and that was initially one of the repositories for OSS agents. Again, from The Advocate by Matthias Schwartz, New York Times Magazine, June 7th of 2020. Barr started his career in the CIA as an analyst, working on China and other matters. When I asked about the origin of his interest in the intelligence service, he responded indirectly with an anecdote about telling his high school guidance counselor that he wanted to be CIA director. It was tempting to link Barr's career and conservatism with his father, Donald Barr, who served in the Office of Strategic Services, the CIA's forerunner during World War II. Donald Barr, who already spoke three languages, had been sent to Missouri to learn Italian. Parenthetically, did he serve in Italy with Alan Dulles, perhaps? Was he in any way involved with the Sunrise negotiations? We don't know. Continuing. Donald Barr's 26-page OSS file, obtained from the National Archives, gives a detailed account of his transition from the military to intelligence work. In 1944, he shipped off to Europe. The next year, 1945, he was assigned to the OSS. In late 1945, he moved to Washington to begin work at the Interim Research and Intelligence Service, which would become the State Department's in-house intelligence bureau. Talking about William Barr. William Barr interned with the CIA in the summers of 1971 and 1972. In 1973, after completing his graduate degree in government and Chinese studies, he married Christine Moynihan, whom he met at a fraternity party. The next day, the couple drove to Washington, and Barr began a permanent job at the CIA the day after that. The new job put Barr on the CIA's seventh floor, not far from the director's office and near the center of what was shaping up to be an historic fight with Congress. Skipping down. The scandals around the Pentagon Papers in 1971 and the Watergate break-in in 1972 culminating in the long-anticipated Vietnam defeat, convinced much of the public that the federal government should no longer be given the benefit of the doubt. In 1973, Richard Helms, the longtime CIA director, ordered the destruction of internal CIA documents regarding MKUltra, an experimental mind control program. Quote, "The program was over," Helms later recalled. "We thought we should just get rid of the files as well, so anybody who had assisted us in the past would not be subject to follow-up or questions, embarrassment, if you will. We kept faith with the people who had helped us, and I see nothing wrong with that," unquote. Rather than accept post-Watergate congressional limitations, the hardliners decamped from the CIA and became floaters, bureaucratic nomads who sought out underused and low-visibility pockets of the federal government from which to wage their war over executive power. The largest battle was fought around the Iran-Contra affair. Many of the Iran-Contra plotters were dragged into the public eye and indicted by a special prosecutor, another post-Watergate innovation. Evidence pointing to the involvement of President Ronald Reagan and Vice President George H.W. Bush was inconclusive. The hardliners felt that foreign policy and covert operations were an exclusively presidential domain. "The business of Congress is to stay the bleep out of my business," unquote, as saw Reagan's first CIA director, William Casey, put it in an interview. And William Barr, by the way, worked very closely with George H.W. Bush, and as people who are familiar with the record note from Wikipedia, of the Wikipedia entry on William Barr, in late 1992, independent counsel Lawrence Walsh, who had been chosen to investigate the Iran-Contra affair, found documents in the possession of Reagan's former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, which Walsh said was, quote, "evidence of a conspiracy among the highest-ranking Reagan administration officials to lie to Congress and the American public," unquote. Weinberger was set to stand trial on felony charges on January 5th of 1993. His, quote, "indictment said Mr. Weinberger's notes contradicted Mr. Bush's assertions that he had only a fragmentary knowledge of the arms secretly sold to Iran in 1985 and 1986 in exchange for American hostages in Lebanon." According to Walsh, then President Bush might have been called as a witness. On December 24th, 1992, during his final month in office, George H.W. Bush, on the advice of Attorney General William Barr, parenthetically, quote, former, unquote, CIA officer, pardoned Weinberger along with five other administration officials who had been found guilty on charges relating to the Iran-Contra affair. Barr was consulted extensively regarding the pardons and especially advocated for pardoning Weinberger. Walsh complained about the move, insinuating that Bush, on Barr's advice, had used the pardons to avoid testifying and stating that, quote, "the Iran-Contra cover-up, which has continued for more than 6 years, has now been completed," unquote. In 2003, he wrote an account of the investigation in his book, Firewall, The Iran-Contra Conspiracy and Cover-Up. Because of this and Barr's unwillingness to appoint an independent counsel to look into a second scandal known as Iraqgate, New York Times writer William Safire began to refer to Barr as, quote, cover-up General Barr. And of Donald Barr's father, again, former OSS agent Donald Barr, who may very well have been involved in some of these shenanigans in Italy and perhaps, who knows, Germany in 1945 that we looked at. From Moyers on Democracy, an article by Heather Cox Richardson, how far do the tentacles of the Jeffrey Epstein case go? It was Barr's father, Donald Barr, the headmaster of the prestigious Dalton School in New York City, who launched Jeffrey Epstein, hiring the 20-year-old math whiz and college dropout Epstein to teach high school calculus and physics. It was a student's father who gave him a start in the more lucrative profession of options trading. I haven't spoken about and won't be talking about the Epstein scandal. There just is too much going on. Suffice it to say that it is one of a number of intelligence-connected sexual blackmail operations with tentacles, the evidentiary tributaries running in many directions. I think it is more than a little interesting that it was Donald Barr who got Jeffrey Epstein his first job, despite the fact that he was a college dropout. He was teaching at the prestigious Dalton School in New York City. A little more about Donald Barr from the Wikipedia entry on Donald Barr, William Barr's father. Donald Barr was headmaster of the Dalton School from 1964 to 1974. During his time as Dalton's headmaster, Barr is alleged to have had a role in hiring Jeffrey Epstein as a math teacher, despite the fact that Epstein had dropped out of college and was only 21 years old at the time. In 1973, Barr published Space Relations, a science fiction novel about a planet ruled by oligarchs who performed child sex slavery. It has been noted that the plot of the novel reflects the crimes of Jeffrey Epstein. Yes, indeed. Now, note that William Barr's specialty was Chinese studies, and he was involved with China as a CIA officer. I have spoken at great length about not only COVID-19, but the fact that COVID-19 took place in the context of not only a full-court press against China, but a number of different overt and covert operations against China as well. One of the central elements in those, both the operations in Hong Kong and with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province, was the National Endowment for Democracy. That was founded by William Casey, as was the Jamestown Institute, and also the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, an offshoot of the Captive Nations Committee, was also founded in the 80s when William Casey was director of the CIA. In our previous program, we took a look at Austin App, who was the head of the Americans of German Heritage. That was he also, Austin App, for many years was head of the Philadelphia branch of the Captive Nations Committee. That was the organization that was sort of the parent organization of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. Again, part of the ABN milieu. That was the sort of vehicle for one of the top, quote, analysts, unquote, to begin the push, so to speak, vis-a-vis the Uyghurs. And again, we looked at that in For the Record, For the Record program number 1143. So bear in mind again that, Casey was head of CIA when many of these fronts were formed. As we looked at in the second program in our series, For the Record program number 11, in the current series, For the Record program 1147, China is really communist in name only. A better term for what China is at this point would be state capitalism. The current China would be unrecognizable either to Karl Marx or to Mao Zedong. Nonetheless, however, the anti-China full court press is consuming the entire, really pretty much the energies of the U.S., our media, our government, our intelligence service, and our military. People have been wondering about the presidential campaign. Congressman Ted Yoho of Florida. I love the name. We don't have any more Yehus. We've got Yohos. Yoho was recently in the news for making vulgar comments to AOC. What did not receive nearly as much attention was Yoho's prediction that there would be a military incident at sea sometime this fall, allegedly precipitated by China, involving some sort of collision between Chinese naval vessels and U.S. vessels. I wonder if some sort of a wag the dog, I think we should be on alert for some sort of wag the dog slash October surprise slash Gulf of Tonkin type incident this fall involving American naval units and Chinese naval units. Hopefully, if such an incident takes place, it won't lead to all-out war. However, keep your eye peeled for an October surprise Gulf of Tonkin type incident to further bolster Donald Trump's campaign this fall. One, we have been speaking in our last, well, really in all of these shows, about the incorporation of the Galen spy organization, which as into our intelligence apparatus, and at the same time, it's fusing with the Republican Party. The significance of William Casey could not be exaggerated. The significance of Alan Dulles cannot be exaggerated. It would be very interesting to know what role Donald Barr played, if any, in those negotiations. One of the things to be kept in mind, and I have not seen this anywhere else except for my own AFA program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, and that is that the Galen Organization and the Underground Reich had intended to use anti-communism as a vehicle for controlling the U.S. From the book that we spoke about this in For the Record Program 971, reviewing from the book General Walker and the Murder of President Kennedy by Jeffrey Caulfield, C-A-U-F-I-E-L-D. One of the things that came to light in Jim Garrison's investigation of the JFK assassination were the observations of Glenn Pinchback. Pinchback was in the operations command at Fort Sill of Oklahoma and learned the following, excerpting from General Walker and the Murder of President Kennedy. Garrison did not provide an explanation for all of David Ferry's notes subject matter. However, he did know the meaning of, quote, flying Barragona in the beach. Beach refers to the model of Ferry's airplane, a beechcraft. Barragona was a Nazi from Fort Sill. Garrison also obtained a transcript of a letter written by Ferry to Barragona. Next to Barragona's name, Garrison wrote, quote, note, Barragona is important, unquote. The letter had been sent to Garrison by Glenn Pinchback, P-I-N-C-H-B-A-C-K, and a carbon copy was sent to Mendel Rivers, a congressman from Georgia. Pinchback worked in the operations command at Fort Sill, where he intercepted mail. In the letter, David Ferry shared his dream of the reunification of Germany and living in a world where all the currency was in Deutschmarks. Pinchback's summation of the letter described, quote, a neo-Nazi plot to enslave America in the name of anti-communism, unquote, and, quote, a neo-Nazi plot gargantuan in scope, unquote. The Ferry letter spoke of the need to kill all the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. Pinchback also reportedly obtained a letter from David Ferry to Barragona confessing his role in the assassination of Robert Gehring, who was a Nazi and Fort Sill soldier. So again, in the context of the full court press against China and the heritage that we have been looking at in the fifth program and concluding program in this series, bear in mind Officer Glenn Pinchback's observations, quote, Pinchback's summation of the letter described, quote, a neo-Nazi plot to enslave America in the name of anti-communism, unquote, and, quote, a neo-Nazi plot gargantuan in scope, unquote. It is not that the Nazis were not anti-communist, but the incorporation of the Galen organization, as I went into at great length in AFA program number 37, was basically the Galen organization was a Trojan horse. It was a vehicle for the ultimate infiltration, and along with, I didn't speak about it then, but the remarkable Bormann network, for the eventual takeover of the U.S. by the Third Reich, a Third Reich gone underground. Again, Pinchback wrote of, quote, a neo-Nazi plot to enslave America in the name of anti-communism. And as we move toward what will be a resumption of our analysis of the COVID-19 plandemic, P-L-A-N-D-E-M-I-C, from the Unit 731 entry in Wikipedia, that is the Japanese Biological Warfare Research Center, I have noted things like the recovery by Fort Detrick scientists of the DNA for the virus that caused the 1918 flu pandemic. As we looked at in the Peterdale Scott essay from Covert Action number 25 from the winter of 1986, one of the things brought in along with Project Paperclip was Unit 731, the most sophisticated biological warfare program on Earth at that time. From the Wikipedia entry, we might note what it was officially labeled as. Quote, it was officially known as the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department of the Kwantung Army. I've noted in our discussions of COVID-19 how the military is not in the business of maintaining public health. They're in the business of warfighting, which involves killing people and either destroying or appropriating property. And I took a look, I ruminated about the Fort Detrick recovery of the 1918 flu virus, that this portended very poorly for the future, and it portended that there would be other epidemics from this. And in a book called Gene Wars, Military Control Over the New Technologies by Charles Piller, P-I-L-L-E-R, and Keith R. Yamamoto, published in hardcover by Beech Tree Books, there is this observation. Jonathan King, who has chaired the microbial, beginning again, Jonathan King, who has chaired the microbial physiology study section for the National Institutes of Health, believes that without intensive independent scrutiny, this is 1988, the Pentagon is free to obscure its true goals. Quote, the Defense Department appears to be pursuing many narrow applied goals that are by nature offensive, such as the genetic, quote, improvement of BW agents. One more time. The Defense Department appears to be pursuing many narrow applied goals that are by nature offensive, such as the genetic, quote, improvement, unquote, of biological warfare agents, King says. Again quoting, "But to achieve political acceptability, they mask these intentions under forms of research such as vaccine development, which sound defensive." Indeed. And this concludes For the Record program number 1150, The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy Part 5, being recorded on September 6th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.